the U.S. side event at the COP24 in Poland, and they did the same thing last year. They spoke about fossil fuels. They spoke about nuclear energy as being a solution to climate change, and this is absolutely not true.
Shame on you! Shame on you!
And that does it for today's show from Katowice, Poland. We'll be broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit throughout the week. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial and streaming live at weft.org. Listen to Democracy Now! Every weekday afternoon on WEFT Community Radio. It's 5 o'clock, and this is the WEFT Courier, a daily information service of WEFT. We broadcast Disability Beat every Monday from 5 to 5:30, followed by Rootstock Radio from 5:30 to 6. Then at 6 p.m., stay tuned for In the Know. And I'd like to get an announcement out from one of our community partners, and then we'll get right to this week's pre-recorded edition of Disability Beat.
WEFT is supported in part by Kevin Elliott Counseling. Elliott Counseling Group has 35 counselors providing mental health services for individuals, families, couples, children, and groups. Evening and weekend appointments are often available immediately. Virtually all insurance, including State of Illinois employee insurance, is accepted, and there is also a self-pay sliding scale. Kevin Elliott or his staff can be reached at 398-9066 or ELLIOTTCounselingGroup.com.
And as I mentioned, this is a pre-recorded edition of Disability Beat. Vicki and Mark were off with their daughter, making sure that her surgery went well. Welcome home, Annie. And here's this week's edition of Disability Beat.
This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded interview with comedian and parent of a child with a disability, Rachel Siegel. But first, disability news for the week of December 10th, 2018. With time and money quickly running out, advocates are pushing for passage of a bill that would extend a federal program that moves people with disabilities from institutions to community living. Congress is scheduled to recess for the year at the end of next week, while every state will run out of funds for the program, known as Money Follows the Person, by the close of the month, said Nicole Jorwick, Director of Rights Policy at the ARC. Money Follows the Person allows states to help people with disabilities transition from nursing homes or other institutions to an apartment or small group home by paying for programs not normally covered by Medicaid, such as employment and housing services. The bill, called the Empower Care Act, would reauthorize the program for 1 year at $450 million, but advocates say a short-term extension could be in the works so more time can be spent next year finding long-term funding. States have helped more than 88,000 people through Money Follows the Person since 2006. The program expired in 2016. At least a dozen states have already spent all of their funds, and the remaining states will soon be out. Sarah Meek, Director of Legislative Affairs for the American Network of Community Options and Resources, or ANCOR, said the legislation has been a high priority for the lame duck session. She said waiting for the new Congress to convene next year will be too late for some people with disabilities. A November Congressional Budget Office report calculated the cost of funding the program for 2 years at $882 million. However, Jorick said the report did not analyze the ultimate savings to Medicaid that result from moving people out of costly institutions. According to Jorick, quote, all of the evaluations that have been done on the program from government agencies or non-governmental entities have shown Medicaid savings of as much as 20% per Medicaid beneficiary per month, end quote. Nonprofit that assists people with intellectual and developmental disabilities started work on solving a problem that faces many of its clients, access to transportation. Most of the people Newstar works with don't drive, and using public transportation can be a challenge, Dan Strick, chief executive, said. Also, they and their families don't always feel comfortable using ride-sharing services. Newstar hopes a new web and mobile application expects to roll out next year called Scoot will change that. Similar to Uber or Lyft, Scoot, or stronger communities through open and organized transportation, will make available drivers specifically trained in working with people with disabilities and with vehicles specially equipped to transport them. Newstar has already raised $90,000 to get Scoot moving and recently was awarded $70,000 through a competition called Arc Tank, a play on Shark Tank overseen by Northeast Arc, the Massachusetts organization services children and adults who have a broad range of disabilities, including intellectual disabilities and autism. Strick said that Scoot was first conceived about 14 months ago, and Newstar started working on it in February of this year. The plan, after testing the application, is to have Scoot available sometime in the spring. Strick said that Newstar clients have reported, quote, bad experiences where they've been taken advantage of, end quote, with some ride-sharing services, and that some of these folks might need a little more assistance than the typical ride-share passenger. Using public transportation also presents obstacles for those with disabilities, he said. He also said Newstar so far has about 25 people lined up as drivers who will undergo training and receive background checks. Like other ride-sharing services, passengers will pay drivers directly for trips. Scoot will have drivers who have access to specially equipped vehicles, such as vans with a lift that can accommodate a wheelchair. Riders will be able to pull up information about drivers, including when a background check was completed and what specialized training the driver has. And finally, students in special education in a Pennsylvania school district are getting a chance to learn life skills and become part of the Boy Scouts of America through a new program. This is the first year the district has participated in the Trailblazers Outreach Program, which is offered at no cost to the district by the Boy Scouts. One classroom from each of the district's four schools is participating. Students will complete the program to become either a Cub Scout or a Boy Scout, depending on their age and learning level. Students get a chance to learn traditional scouting skills like archery, how to work in a group, and how to be a good citizen, but also life skills like managing money and how to apply for a job. Students meet twice a month with Bob Zalesnik, who is the Trailblazer Executive with the Laurel Highlands Council of the Boy Scouts. Students are presented a modified version of the typical Boy Scout and Cub Scout lessons. Zalesnik said, quote, I see how excited and how happy the kids are to actually participate in our program, end quote. The Laurel Highlands Council is one of only a few in the country to offer this program. Zalesnik said about 1,200 students in the region now participate. In addition to their lessons, the students also get to take part in Camp Gayasuda events each fall and spring, where they practice archery, have hay rides, and participate in field games. They also get to participate in the Pinewood Derby in the spring. Once students complete the program, they are encouraged to join a local Cub Scout or Boy Scout pack. Zalesnik said local leaders are trained on how to successfully integrate a scout with special needs. And that's the news for this week.
We're working together to get things done. So the Rhythm Railroad is number one. Clear the trees out and lay the tracks. Carry the heavy lumber on our back.
Down the railroad ties, slap your knees in the gravel ties, laying down the rail. So this is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, joined today by my guest on the phone, Rachel Siegel. And Rachel and I have connected via friends of a friend of a friend, so I'm really, really glad to have her on the program today. Rachel is a writer and performer who has worked in both TV and theater on two continents, as a matter of fact. She is most at home doing comedy and recently performed at the Boston Women in Comedy Festival back in 2013, shortly after the birth of her son Patrick, who has Down syndrome. So there's something that she and I have in common. Siegel also has an older son who is 5, and she and her husband and children live in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts. So welcome to the program, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So glad to have you on. You know, I don't nearly often enough have parents of young children on the program, but I know there are a number of families who listen or share information about what they hear regarding young children with disabilities with people that they know. So thank you so much for joining me today. It's really great that you are here. So why don't we start by just having you tell a little bit about yourself and your experience to the listeners, and we'll take it from that point forward.
Sure, yeah. So we found out, should I take it from the prenatal phase?
Why don't you start by telling about a little bit about yourself professionally first?
Okay. Sure. So I trained as an actor in England at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art after college, and thought I would have a career there and here as an actor, and realized I sort of didn't want to live over there full time. So I came back here in 2000, and after having worked there for about a year and a half as an actor, and came back to New York, worked between New York and the Berkshires, which is where I'm from, where there's a very lively theater scene, and sort of moved between both of those places, and met my husband in 2007, and we moved up to the Berkshires about a year and a half after that, where we have 2 boys, as you mentioned, and I've done various other things too, but right now I'm mostly home, but I also write, and was recently in a performance about birth called Can You Hear Me, Baby, which was great. Shout out for them at the Unicorn Theater here. It was a really wonderful musical. It was actually an original musical with new music by a woman called Lisa Raphael. And she asked for my birth story, too, about Patrick. So that was part of the piece, too. I didn't deliver that monologue, but another actress did, and she did beautifully. So my birth story about Patrick got to be part of that evening, too.
So tell us a little bit about Patrick and your story.
So we found out prenatally that Patrick had Down syndrome back in, let's see, he was born in 2012, and it's kind of an interesting story, because I thought I was pregnant back in October, and my period, I wasn't pregnant, and my doctor, and then the following cycle, we tried again, and I tested positive. So because I think children with Down syndrome measure smaller, my doctor thought I had gotten pregnant, in fact, the second month, when really I was pregnant the first month. So my doctor would probably dispute this, I should say, even now, but Patrick was born exactly a month early. He was born on what would have been my due date had they gotten it right. And So when we found out at our 15-week quad screen that we had a 1 in 2 chance of chromosomal abnormality, which in that case we didn't know which it was, we were in fact 19 weeks along instead of 15 weeks. So I say that just because, you know, we would have made the choice we made anyway. We felt strongly about that. But it was just an interesting series of events that, in fact, we ended up having Patrick a month before we expected, and he was born on our vacation on Cape Cod. So, we did find out prenatally that he had Down syndrome, and had a tough month of making a decision, although I felt really in my heart the decision was made as soon as we found out, and he had been kicking for a month already, over a month in fact. And I just felt very connected to him, and I felt a very deep sense of trust, like almost like nothing else I've ever experienced in my life, that I I just felt this baby was going to be great and he was going to be fine. And I just felt that I loved him, and my husband, thank goodness, was incredibly supportive. And just we both felt behind the idea. We have very supportive families. And it helped as well that his, when we found out we were actually on vacation again in Mexico, and when our doctor told us that, in fact, our amnio had come out, that Patrick did have Down syndrome. And we were with two of John's sisters, who one of whom is a special ed teacher who's worked with kids with Down syndrome her whole life. And she just said to us, you're going to have a life full of love.
Mm.
So that
there
really
are so many helped. Families who don't make that choice. You know, it's really scary to me. I'm the parent of a daughter with Down syndrome, and Annie is now 32 years old. Back in the day, you know, it was very, you know, there was no question. There were very, very few tests that were accurate at that point. In fact, I did have a blood test for her, and they said, oh, everything's fine. Yet when she was born, obviously she did have Down syndrome, but now people have a choice. And it scares me to think that so many babies with Down syndrome are losing their lives just because it's inconvenient for family members. So I applaud you for your decision. How is Patrick doing now?
He is doing fantastically. We've been so lucky, I have to say. He's been so healthy. We've had my older son has asthma, and he's been in the hospital more than Patrick ever has. And Patrick hasn't had any major health issues, touch wood. And he is just totally delightful. I feel like he's brought so much. He's, as my sister calls him, the love mentor. He's really brought a sort of cascading effect. And it happens sort of slowly over time. You know, he's 2 3/4 now. But to both my extended family, John's extended family, and I think we all feel really touched by him. And I think he's changed the way people see Down syndrome and see disability beyond our family. I feel like the ripple effects are ongoing. You know, people I reach on Facebook and people who hear our story through different, you know, I wrote a piece about Patrick and for a festival, the Berkshire Festival of Women Writers here, about a month ago, and had a really great response from that. And it's just, you know, it's just something I feel I need to tell, but it's also really wonderful to realize that, gosh, maybe there's actually, I mean, if I change one person's mind, you know, that feels like a big deal. And I think a lot of people have communicated with me that they have never known anyone with Down syndrome or never, you know, seen a family with Down syndrome. It seemed happy and to be thriving.
You know, a lot of families will go through struggles of, you know, being depressed and upset about the diagnosis. Now, you knew in advance. Did you still have that same reaction at first, or were you very well balanced and just moved on and you know, went about your business?
Well, you know, it's funny because I definitely went through a hard time when I was pregnant, and I was sort of, you know, I just would feel sad about, you know, about the idea. If I heard a story of a family with a child with Down syndrome that had struggled, I would feel really sad and worried. So I definitely did go through that. But I feel really grateful that Patrick's birth was so joyful because we did know in advance and we had made this choice that we felt good about. And when he was born, like I said, on our vacation on Cape Cod, and he was born in 2 hours, like he was born incredibly quickly. And I actually thought, because I was a month early and I was, some part of me I think knew, but another part of me was in denial. And I thought he was a kidney stone. And I turned up at the hospital and said, I think I have a kidney stone.
Oh,
and
my.
We were on our vacation and this doctor didn't know us from Adam, a son on Cape Cod. And she just looked at me and said, this isn't a kidney stone, Miss Siegel. You're going to have, you're 8 centimeters dilated and you're having a baby in about a half an hour.
Oh my gosh. It was that long before? Oh my gosh. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, it was a little longer, it was about an hour after that. But, you know, and all of our family was out there because we were all vacationing together. So it was just this incredible, impromptu, incredibly joyful event. And it was so lovely that at the hospital, the staff actually said to me, I've never seen a family so happy to welcome a child with Down syndrome. And because we were just, I mean, it was the most joyful period of my life, those first 2 days. It was just something transcendent about it. It was that's really great.
That's wonderful.
I will say that, you know, some of the struggles, I mean, I'm having a hard time now because he's transferring to school, and that transition is tricky.
Mm.
So I'm looking to connect with other moms about that, because you just feel, you know, you create a bubble for your child at home where they're completely loved, and you feel you create a really joyful, positive atmosphere. But then you have to let your baby go, and you have to let, you know, this more vulnerable child out into the world. And I find myself struggling with that now.
So you're looking at an early childhood program for him? Is that?
Yeah, he's actually in a preschool now, and we're working on his, this is a private preschool, and then we're working on his IEP for he'll turn 3 in July. So he'll go to the public school and have all of his services there in September. So we're starting that process too.
Yeah, that's always challenging for sure. Are you connected to other parents in your community that have kids with Down syndrome, or is it too small?
I will say that that's a hard thing, because we live in a really rural area, and there are really few. I don't know any children within a year of Patrick's age within an hour's radius.
So
I have friends who are like an hour away, who are a little older, and then I have a friend who's an hour and a half away. I have friends in New York and Boston, but these are just people that I've met, other than one, just people who I've met through kind of Down syndrome circles. So it can be a little lonely here, and that's one thing we think about, is moving to a more urban area where Patrick would have more peers.
Mm-hmm. Have you put some thought into, you know, in a couple of years he's going to be kindergarten age? What are you thinking as far as public school goes?
Well, we're really lucky to have really good public schools here, and although my older son goes to a private school, he'll probably go to public school next year. And although we're not sure, but the schools, I haven't met the special, I'm really just starting this process, so I haven't met the special ed director, but my sister used to teach in this school system, and I have friends. It's a very small community, and I grew up here too, so I sort of know everybody, and everybody knows me, and people know us, and they're getting to know Patrick. So I feel, fingers crossed, it'll be a good experience here, and there won't be a lot of, I just know that a lot of parents through Facebook groups and things, that they really struggle for their services and to get really good inclusion for their kids in school, and I'm hoping that we won't have that here.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because my own daughter was included in general education classes all the way through from kindergarten through her graduation from high school. So it can be done, and it can be successful.
Wow.
And she's living on her own now, so that's a plus too. So,
oh, wow, how wonderful.
Can you talk a little bit about how your experience as being a parent of a young child with Down syndrome has impacted your work as an actress, as a writer?
Yeah, good question. This is something I've kind of struggled with, because I love comedy, and that's kind of where my heart is. And when I was pregnant with him, I was really prolifically writing like spec TV scripts, and I was really kind of feeling ambitious and excited about comedy writing and performing career. And I suddenly thought, is anything going to be funny again? You know, when I was going through this, when we found out, and I thought, okay, is Down syndrome and sort of disability going to be this thing that kind of takes over, and I'm going to be like that terribly serious mom who's marching in all the marches, you know, you know, being an activist, and I have an activist side of me, but I tend to think that people's minds are best changed through art and through relationship, you know, and the kind of connection that you can get through art and entertainment. I'm happy to say that I feel like I've come out the other side of that and found ways to be playful, you know. I mean, first of all, life hasn't, you know, felt terrible, so there's been lots of stuff that's funny, and I've found ways to be playful even in the sort of disability context, I'm happy to say. And I'm working now on, I have a sort of long-term idea of a piece that's Down syndrome related, and that's really all I can say about it, because it's sort of a germ of an idea, and I'm excited to work on that. And, you know, I think for me it's actually kind of useful, because I have a hard time narrowing down my focus. I think of all these things I want to do, and it's hard for me to just zero in on one thing, and and this is something that's like, oh, okay, this is a focus now, you know?
Absolutely.
So raising awareness, yeah, about Down syndrome and about, and just trying to let people know that it's just not that bad. I mean, that's kind of something I hear a lot of people say, like, people really think that raising a child with Down syndrome must be so dark and horrible, and there's just such a legacy of shame and darkness about it that I really just feel a sense of mission to just be like, let's let the light in here. Get to know someone with Down syndrome, get to know a kid with Down syndrome, you know, and just let the fear and the shame dissipate as it just inevitably does, you know, when there's real relationship and connection. So
sure.
I definitely, in my work, feel like a mission about that.
And I tell people, if you know a child with Down syndrome, you know one child with Down syndrome, because everyone is just as unique as anybody else in the world.
Right, totally.
So what's the message that, I mean, we have a lot of listeners who have, you know, young children with Down syndrome, or maybe have had, or maybe are going to have. What is the one thing that you would like them most to understand about your experience about having a child with Down syndrome?
Hmm. Oh, yeah, I was afraid you were going to ask that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say what I just said, that I mean, I tend to see it. My husband is a yoga teacher and a meditator, and is sort of has a very developed spiritual practice. So he's kind of my mentor in these things, and I feel very grateful for that. And he, every time I'm sort of melting down and thinking, how are we going to do this? And this is really hard. He just sort of says, you know, everybody has something. And it's like, we were just reading this book by an author, Jon Kabat-Zinn, Full Catastrophe Living, which a lot of people might know, a very popular book written 20 years ago or so. And he talks about what's the best, you know, one of the best things that can happen to someone is to get really sick, to get a disease, because it forces, that doesn't kill you, because it forces you to take your health really seriously and to put your health first. And I feel like on a spiritual level, you know, I think a lot of people suffer spiritually and feel unhappy. You know, I include myself in this. I've had a lot of long periods of being anxious and unhappy in my life. And I feel like this kind of event is something that people would dread happening to them. And people have said that to me. That's my worst fear, they said to me, you know. And I think, you know, well, yeah, maybe it was kind of mine. In some ways, it was mine, too. And I feel like, and now I'm like, it's like fear proof or something, you know? It's like, it forces me to be like, to face all of my demons and just be like, and find all the joy and happiness in life. It isn't about the kind of emptier things, you know? It isn't about how successful I am or how, you know, how much money I have or, you know, how many things I've achieved. It's like, it's got to be about something deeper. It's got to be about more deep values, you know?
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Rachel. Do you have a website? Yeah, I know you have said you have a blog, right? Can you direct
me? I do. I have a website that has some comedy videos on it and even some like audio stuff. I record audio books too. It's funnycryhappy.net.
Funnycryhappy.net. Thank you so much for joining me today, Rachel Siegel.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. No, I stand my ground. Won't be turned around. Dragging me down, gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down.
This is WEFT Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial, and streaming live at weft.org. Listen to Disability Beat every Monday at 5 on WEFT Community Radio. And again, welcome home, Annie. At 5:30 each weekday, you can hear a different information program. On Mondays, we bring you Rootstock Radio, which is coming up next. Then at 6 p.m., stay tuned for In the Know. And I'd like to